MyAudiobooks.ai presents The Arctic Line Item, the offshore drilling rules buried in a routine document. On August 14, 2026, the Department of the Interior published its semi-annual regulatory agenda in the Federal Register, a document so routine that most years it is read only by the lawyers paid to track it. Buried in this year's edition, between timber management schedules and grazing fee updates, are two line items that will shape one of the last great fights in American energy: revisions to the rules for exploratory drilling on the Arctic Outer Continental Shelf, and new requirements for how offshore platforms get decommissioned, cleaned up, plugged, and removed when the oil is gone.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts. Turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. During our research into the primary agenda document, the two rulemaking tracks it contains, and the 40-year fight over who gets to drill America's Arctic waters, we found a story about how the biggest environmental decisions get made in the least read documents in government, what the decommissioning rule really prices, and why the Arctic OCS is the chess square where energy dominance and climate policy keep meeting.
Section 1. How the real rules get written.
To understand why this document matters, you have to understand the machinery of American regulation. The laws that govern offshore drilling, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act and its descendants, are decades old. What those laws actually mean in practice is decided by regulation. The 1,000-page rulebooks written by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, the two obscure interior agencies that run the offshore program. And those rulebooks are telegraphed twice a year in the Unified Agenda, a listing of every rule every agency intends to write.
It is the least read, most important document in the federal government. The place where the next 2 years of environmental policy are spelled out in advance, in plain sight, in language designed to put a general reader to sleep. And this year's edition carries the Arctic in two quiet paragraphs.
The agenda system itself is a study in hiding in plain sight. Twice a year, spring and fall, every federal agency files its intentions into a single consolidated listing, thousands of entries, each carrying a title, a timetable, and a few lines of abstract. Trade associations assign staff to read every line. Environmental groups do the same. The general press? Almost never. By the time a rule becomes a news story, the agenda has been advertising it for months. The oil lobby knew, the green groups knew, and the public finds out when the drilling starts. It is the closest thing Washington has to a futures market for regulation, and it is free to read, which is why the people whose money depends on the Arctic have read every word of it, and the public whose coastline it is has read none.
The two agencies deserve an introduction because their split personality is the program. BOEM writes the leasing plans and the environmental reviews. It decides where drilling can happen. BSEE writes the safety and engineering standards. It decides how. The two were created from the wreckage of the old Minerals Management Service after Deepwater Horizon, on the theory that the agency selling the leases should not also be the agency policing the wells. That divorce is why the agenda carries both names, and why each rule lands in two versions, the auctioneer and the inspector, working the same coastline.
The two Arctic entries in the August agenda are short and dry. One covers the exploratory drilling requirements for the Arctic OCS, the standards for how companies may drill in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. The other covers decommissioning, the financial and technical obligations to plug wells, remove platforms, and restore the seabed when production ends. Between those two sentences lies the entire practical question of Arctic drilling. Not whether it is legal, but what it costs to do it.
what it costs to clean up after, and who is left holding the bill when the music stops.
Section 2. The Arctic OCS and the 40-year standoff. The Arctic Outer Continental Shelf, the shallow seas off Alaska's northern coast, holds some of the largest undiscovered oil resources in American jurisdiction and sits inside some of the most extreme operating conditions on Earth. Moving pack ice, months of darkness, storms that can trap a rig in hours, and an ecosystem that supports subsistence hunting for the communities along its shore. Every administration of the past four decades has fought over the same few questions: whether to lease, where to lease, and what standards to impose on whoever drills. The resource numbers explain why the fight never dies. Government geologists have long estimated the Arctic OCS holds tens of billions of barrels of undiscovered oil, the largest single prospective prize left in American waters. Against that prize sits an operating environment with no true analog elsewhere in the industry, a drilling season measured in weeks between ice cycles, supply chains that stretch 1,000 miles from the nearest deepwater port, and spill response physics that simply do not work in slush and dark. Every rule about relief wells and containment domes is an attempt to put a price on that environment's hostility, and every revision of the price changes who can afford to bid. The history of that fight explains why the rules matter more than the acreage. After the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster, the offshore rulebook was rewritten around the blowout scenario, the requirement that a driller prove it could contain and kill a runaway well before being allowed to spud. In the Arctic, that requirement collides with physics. A blowout in October cannot be answered until the ice retreats months later. The exploratory drilling standards written in response demanded same-season relief well capability, containment domes staged on site, and spill response fleets on standby, requirements so expensive they effectively rationed Arctic drilling to the handful of companies that could afford the insurance policy.
Every revision to those standards is, in effect, a decision about how many companies get to play and how much risk the ocean absorbs.
The standoff has a rhythm. Leases get issued in one administration, restricted in the next, litigated in between. The exploratory drilling rules now flagged for revision were written to answer the nightmare scenario, a blowout under the ice, where a relief well cannot be drilled in the dark of winter, and a spill cannot be skimmed from moving flows. Revising those rules is a statement about which risk the current administration prices higher: the risk of an Arctic spill, or the risk of leaving the resource in the ground while the country pursues an energy dominance agenda.
Section 3. The rule that prices the cleanup.
The decommissioning track is the quieter of the two, and in the long run, the more consequential. Offshore decommissioning is the oil industry's unglamorous mortgage. Thousands of wells and hundreds of platforms in federal waters will eventually need to be plugged and removed at costs that run into the tens of billions. The question the rule answers is who pays? The companies that profited or the public when a bankrupt operator leaves its wells behind? The Gulf of Mexico already carries a roster of orphaned wells from companies that sold assets down a chain of weaker and weaker buyers until the last one folded. The new requirements are about forcing the true cost of the cleanup onto the balance sheet, up front, through bonds and financial assurance, before the wells ever drilled.
The scale of that mortgage is the part the public never sees. A single deepwater platform can cost hundreds of millions to remove. A single subsea well can cost tens of millions to plug correctly. And plug wrong, it leaks for generations. Federal records over the past decade have shown the assurance regime lagging the liability by a wide margin, bonds sized for yesterday's costs against tomorrow's cleanup. When operators fail, the wells go orphaned. and orphaned wells are the purest externality in American energy. The profit left years ago. The risk remains, and the invoice drifts toward the taxpayer. The decommissioning rule is an attempt to break that chain at the first link, the moment of assignment, when a strong operator hands a late-life asset to a weak one.
That single mechanism, making the end-of-life cost visible at the beginning, changes the economics of the whole offshore program. If the full cost of plugging and removal must be bonded at the start, marginal fields stop penciling out, and the weakest operators stop qualifying to play. The decommissioning rule is, in effect, a production decision disguised as an accounting rule. This content is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment or policy advice. Section 4. The original angle, the agenda as the battlefield. Set the two tracks side by side, and the strategic picture emerges. The drilling rule revision tells you where the administration wants production to go: the Arctic, the last great frontier. The decommissioning rule tells you how it intends to answer the cleanup critique, not by slowing the drilling, but by pricing the ending. It is a coherent package: open the frontier, harden the exit. And it is being advanced not through legislation or executive order, but through the ordinary machinery of rulemaking, where fights are won on technical appendices and the public comment periods that almost no public reads.
The pairing is the tell of a sophisticated strategy. Opening the Arctic alone would have drawn the full arsenal of environmental opposition. Pairing it with the toughest cleanup financing rules in the program's history gives the administration a defensive line. The argument that this is not the wild frontier, but the fully priced one. Whether that defense survives contact with the details depends entirely on the numbers that follow. The bonding levels, the containment requirements, the season windows. An agenda entry is an intention. The rule text is the weapon. Everyone who fights these battles knows the difference, which is why the lobbyists read the agenda so much more carefully than the public does.
That is the pattern worth naming. The great energy fights of this decade are not being decided on the floor of Congress or in televised hearings. They are being decided in the pages of the unified agenda, in the space between an item's title and its abstract, where a single revised requirement can move billions of dollars of capital and decades of Arctic coastline without ever becoming a headline. The document is the battlefield. Almost nobody is watching it. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines.
Section 5. What to look for next. The first signal is the proposed rule text itself. When the Arctic drilling revision drops, the details, relief well timelines, containment requirements, season length, will reveal whether this is a modest update or a wholesale rewrite of the post-spill standards. The second is the financial assurance numbers in the decommissioning proposal. The bonding levels will determine which operators can afford the frontier and which are priced out of it. The third is the litigation lineup. Environmental groups and the state of Alaska read the same agenda, and the lawsuits are drafted before the rules are. Watch for the pre-positioned challenges the day any final rule posts.
The fourth is the lease sale calendar. Rule revisions without acreage are theory, and the next five-year offshore program will show whether the Arctic entries were intent or theater. The fifth is the industry response. If the majors start staffing Arctic teams again after a decade of retreat, the signal is that they believe the rules will hold through the next election. If they stay away, the frontier stays theoretical. The sixth is the court calendar. The Arctic has lived in litigation longer than it has lived in production, and the next ruling on the underlying leases frames everything the new rules touch. Each of these determines whether the August agenda was a bureaucratic non-event or the opening move in the last great offshore fight.
Section 6. The broader pattern and open question. The broad pattern is that environmental policy has migrated from the statute books to the appendices.
The laws on the books have not changed in decades. What changes is the 1,000-page machinery beneath them, written by agencies, challenged in court, rewritten by the next administration. The result is a kind of permanent regulatory oscillation, where the Arctic is alternately open and closed, depending on the election cycle. And the only constant is the legal industry the oscillation feeds, and the coastline that waits, year after year, for a permanent answer no one will give it.
There is a second pattern, and it is about attention. The democratic process is very good at watching speeches, and very bad at watching agendas. The 4-page notice of a rulemaking can carry more consequence than a year of floor debate, and yet it arrives with no cameras, no ribbon, no hashtag. The decisions that shape the coastlines and the cleanup bills are being made in the fine print, and they have been for a long time. Every scandal that eventually breaks into the open, every orphaned well and every Arctic lease fight, was visible first in a document like this one, months or years before anyone called it news.
Which leaves the open question. When the Arctic rules are finally written and the cleanup is finally priced, will the frontier open with its true costs on the table? Or will the pattern hold and the real bill arrive decades from now, in a different administration, on a different balance sheet? The agenda is published. The comment periods are open. The Arctic is waiting, as it has waited through 40 years of line items and lawsuits, for someone to decide what it is for. A frontier? A preserve? Or a permanent stalemate between the two? And the answer, as always, will be written where almost nobody is reading.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.